Last week, Melbourne moved into stage 4 lockdown.
Essentially, we can't leave our house for any reason other than one of the 4 major reasons.
If we have certain permits to work.
Seeking medical care.
Medical care.
Only go outside for 1 hour of exercise.
And also you're only allowed when exercising in like a 5 kilometre kind of radius of your house.
Shopping for essential goods and services.
Only one person in the household can go to the supermarket, and essentially all shops have shut.
And everything else is like, no.
And you can't have anyone come over, so you're just isolated to your house and your family, or in my case, my 4 housemates.
There's no allowance for going and gardening with your auntie on a Saturday in exchange for like avocados and eggs. Like, that's not allowed.
That's not on the list.
It's not on the list. It should be on the list, but it's not on the list. To start off this week, we're checking in with some friends in Melbourne. First up, I called my cousin Aisha, who had her second baby 3 months ago during the first lockdown. She also has a 2-year-old.
Yeah, so having a baby during the first wave was a little bit anxiety provoking, just because it was pretty early in the pandemic and we didn't know what the effect of the virus was on pregnant women and newborn babies. So, hi, my name's Aisha. I'm in Fitzroy, which is inner city Melbourne. And I am currently sitting under my 3-month-old baby who was born in the middle of the sort of first wave of COVID. My little baby hasn't really met anyone, which is really sad. So he hasn't had sort of cuddles from friends and family. And as of tomorrow, our 2.5-year-old won't be able to attend childcare anymore either. So that's going to be super challenging, trying to entertain a toddler and look after a newborn. He's become a lot more challenging in his behaviours over the last couple of weeks. And I mean, part of that is his age, and part of it is becoming an older sibling and having a baby to contend with. But a lot of it is also because all of his constants have been taken away. So childcare, grandparents, playgrounds, all the things we usually do with him are changing, and he doesn't understand. We've tried, and he sort of looks at the playground and says, "Oh, sad mummy, playground closed." And then he'll look at me again and say, "Man in truck, come open playground now. I play." So he's so cute. He thinks that we can just ask the man in the truck to come and open the playground. He just doesn't quite understand that that's not going to happen for another couple of months.
Everyone we spoke to had the same concerns about, like, how long is this going to last, and when am I going to see my friends and family again? One of the people we spoke to was Anika, a volunteer at Syn Media. She's finishing high school this year, and one of the things her and her friends are stressed about is the possibility that they'll be spending the rest of their last year of high school away from each other.
And one of my friends was like, "Oh, like, imagine not spending the last year, the last term of your schooling with your friends." And that's when it kind of hit me, and I was like, "Oh, like, damn." Like, it was just a very, I guess, overwhelming thought.
So my name's Jordan Fennell. I'm the Victorian State Coordinator for All the Best. I'm also a journalist with the ABC, and I'm currently in stage 4 lockdown in Melbourne. The rest of my family live in South Australia at the moment. So I was like, "Oh my God, I'm just never going to get to see them again." When the stage 4 restriction happened earlier in the week, that was a big, like, oh my goodness, I felt really heavy, and I felt very sad, and I let myself be sad. Hopefully by Christmas time, the borders are open, but obviously there's no guarantee in that.
My name's Imogen. I am 26, living in Melbourne, and all of my family live in far north Queensland. It was my dad's 70th birthday on the 25th of July, and I couldn't really get him anything. And I don't really like gifts in general, or cards. I don't like them. But it was a milestone birthday, so I decided to make something. And Dad hates homemade gifts with a burning passion, and so I made him a homemade gift. And I made a song, essentially. He used to sing to us as kids, and he would always make this big song and dance about it. And he would, like, grab out his guitar and, like, throw things around the room and just, like, do anything in order to, you know, entertain the kids before bed. And so I made a medley of pretty much every song he's ever sung to us or flogged around the house and mashed them all up into this song. Of course, like every single one follows the same four chords, I swear to God. But mashed up all the lyrics from these songs. And there must have been like 12 songs in it. And then played two like harmonies of violin underneath because I can play the violin. And then some ukulele. And I put it all together in this video and filmed myself wearing all these different hats, which was like a tribute to this video I made for him when I was 18 and moved out of home for the first time and I couldn't go home for his birthday then. And I sent it to them. We had a Zoom call. I shared my screen. I played the video. And Phoebe, my sister, was just like bawling her eyes out. And Mum was like, Emmy, I thought I was going to cry. And I was like, but Dad, like, did you cry? And he didn't cry at all. But he downloaded the video and he sent it to every relative. And I know because I keep getting notifications being like, so-and-so random email addresses requested to view this file. And he's played it on repeat. So at least he's got this video, at least, of me. And that was his request, was his birthday present, was for me to play music with him. So I couldn't do that, but I played music for him instead.
Emma, that's so beautiful.
Yeah, it makes me sad. Yeah.
Yeah, you must miss them so much.
Yeah, I do.
I studied evil. I can't deny. Was a hoodoo charm called Love Me or Die. And she was stretched out on that long wet table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Whoops. And she left in the fold, that's her picture in the wall. She always had a little drop of poison.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. This episode, Long Distance. In our first story, Lydia packs her bags for a last-minute flight out of London.
Broth ingredients: onions, ginger, garlic, chilies, miso, tahini, veg stock, soy sauce.
Around 11 a.m, I'm holding up a mate's secondhand cardigan, trying to decide if I can fit it into my suitcase or if it needs to go to the charity shop. It's a bit of a moot point. I haven't actually figured out yet how I'm going to ship everything back, and in any case, the secondhand stores are closed until who knows when. There's barely any time between now and tomorrow night to make these kinds of packing decisions. I had finally sat down to book my flight that morning. I'd read that multiple borders were shutting to non-citizens, even transiting passengers. Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Singapore, Hong Kong. So, in a rush, I bought a ticket home from Heathrow Airport. To be honest, it's a decision I'd been putting off for weeks, even as the lockdown situation grew more serious. I kept avoiding questions from family and friends back home. And finally, my parents made me promise to buy a ticket before we Skyped the next day. Back to the chaos of my half-packed room. I panic and I start doing the rounds on my housemates. I'm trying to palm off my houseplants, a candle, a poster, my favourite green IKEA lamp. There's a sudden pressure to wrap things up quickly and neatly. Shedding personal belongings gives me some sense of control over the fact that something else, an invisible force changing people's lives everywhere, has decided when I should leave. By the afternoon, most of my room is either tucked away, folded up, or in the garden shed. So it makes sense that that's when I get an email from Etihad. My flight's been cancelled. An hour later, through to a customer service rep, I get told the UAE borders actually closed an hour ago, rather than in 2 days' time like I'd read online. I've still got adrenaline pumping through me as I give everyone the news, again, that I'm staying, actually. It takes me a week to unpack my bags. And some things stay bubble wrapped and in the suitcase. I don't bother to take them back out. Part of me suspects it won't be long before I start packing again. Our house reduces from 6 to 4. Two of our housemates, Kyle and Emily, leave to go stay with Kyle's mum outside London. She's over 60 and a bit more vulnerable, given the circumstances. It's an uncertain time, and we're all looking for stability where we can. In the next couple of weeks, cases start to rise rapidly in the UK, with over 2,000 daily cases getting announced by the end of March. But there's a sort of consensus among my family and friends back home that maybe it's safer to shelter in place now. All the borders for a transiting Australian from Europe have basically closed. I start checking the Australian High Commission in the UK's Facebook page daily for updates. The advice is consistent and a little scary. Consider your safety in the UK. Consider what support networks you have. When I hear about the Qantas repatriation flights just announced, I rush to book another ticket home. It's 9:30 on a Saturday night. We're finally serving up dinner, the last house dinner before our housemate Tori goes home. I've been cooking for 4.5 hours, and I've roped my remaining housemates into helping with my very ambitious plan. Well, actually, they offered to help because they're good people. The smacked cucumber, fried cabbage with chili. Basically, every surface in the kitchen is covered in oil from where we pulled, stretched, and smacked the biang biang noodles on the counter. We're quickly trying to scoop them out from the pot. There are some stray bits bubbling away in the boiling water from the noodles that got stretched a bit too thinly. It's definitely amateur hour. I'll be the first to admit it. But as we finally sit down to eat, Mano and Angus feed my ego a little. Apparently, it tastes pretty close to their favourite noodles, from a local place near us called Xi'an Impression. I never got to try them, and I guess I won't get to now. But it's still pretty gratifying to hear. Apparently, they'd been craving them for a while. It's another lockdown recipe that's been doing the rounds, actually. Like sourdough or banana bread. It comes from the Instagram account of an Ottolenghi test kitchen chef and fellow North Londoner. Turns out, she was trying to work out how to make those same Xi'an Impression noodles, because she'd been craving them in lockdown too. Anyway, we share some beers. And after that, we're kind of too exhausted to do much else. But navigating that kitchen chaos together kind of feels like enough in itself. On Tuesday night, there's another low-key farewell dinner for me. I'm flying out the next day. The UK had 3,996 new cases that day. Just as we're about to dig into some takeaway curries, a couple of our mates show up at the door. They linger in the doorway and just behind that, in the concrete yard. I fish around in a paper bag that I get given. I pull out a handful of paper cards. Turning them over, front to back, I see they've got recipes handwritten on them. One's for homemade hot and tangy sauce, written out on shiny gold cardboard. On the back of a postcard, Angus has written out his specialty, the carbonara he taught us to make last week. Holding them is like holding an explosion of colour, of memories, of meals I've heard about and wanted to try, cooked for birthdays, cooked for dinner parties. Max's veggie ramen is a throwback to Chef Mira Soda, whose cookbooks he and Rosa first showed me in their South London kitchen. Recently, I'd been asking a few friends about their favourite recipes, because I wanted to collect them myself, into a kind of homemade recipe book. But holding these cards in my hands is an actual tangible reminder of the last year and a half, of the people I've met, and of the moments shared. It's way better than a recipe link sent over WhatsApp. It's a way to come back, whenever I want, despite the thousands of kilometers between us. As long as I've got a kitchen to use and some ingredients to spare. Limited food service on board. I don't really know what that means until I'm on the 16 and a half hour flight from Heathrow to Perth. Minimalistic is what it means, I guess. The plane lights slowly flicker back on. Flight attendants come down the aisles with trolleys. It's the strangest meal I've shared. Suspended in the air, and spaced out with a seat between each of us. Masks getting adjusted on faces, getting ready to eat. No one really talks as you'd expect. We all face the same direction as we sit and eat. I wonder where the provided plane food comes from. We get little packets of snacks, Tim Tams included, at our final stop in Melbourne. And I wonder who put those together. I spend the next 14 days in Melbourne's hotel quarantine. The knock at the door always comes at roughly the same time of day for each meal. For dinner, it's between 6 and 7 p.m. It's usually followed by a muffled voice from outside the door, announcing food service. I assume all the travellers more or less eat the same meals provided, probably at the same time. But for one thing, we don't share the same space. Obviously we can't. We're each in our anonymous hotel rooms. And those interactions that happen in the kitchen and around the dinner table are missing. And for another thing, I know the folks across the hall from me are making good use of Uber Eats. And fair enough. One thing I miss is the control of choosing and making your own meal.
Veg, any of, squash, aubergine, fennel, broccoli, whatever else you fancy.
I'm cutting broccoli right now. And I'm kind of guessing all of the quantities of the veggies.
Assembling ingredients.
Sesame oil, soy sauce, mirin.
Working steadily through the steps to an end result.
There's step three.
Number three. Roast your chosen vegetables.
In a time as weird and murky and unpredictable as this, you get some semblance of choice. You get to put an intention behind what you make. And sometimes you don't get the result that you want, like the stray bits of noodle left in the pot. But you can try, and you can serve up that effort and intention and care to someone else.
Hot frothy broth, aka all the men's ramens. On to the method. Number one, fry the onions until super soft. Add lots of garlic, ginger, and chilies and fry for 2 more minutes. Number two, add 2 tablespoons each of miso, tahini, and soy sauce and 1 liter of veg stock. Turn down the heat and leave to bubble away.
So the base of the broth is bubbling away. Sort of very gently simmering away on the stove.
Number three, roast your chosen vegetables with a splash of soy sauce, sesame oil, and mirin or rice wine.
Here we go. It's in there.
Until tender.
I reckon what I'm going to do is just turn the oven off now and let them chill out in there for a little bit. I'm cutting the tofu that's going to get fried in step... Which step is it?
Number four. Slice the tofu into big slabs and fry in a non-stick pan until golden, turning occasionally. Number five. Cook the noodles, however the packet says, then cool them under the tap.
Well, according to the instructions for these ramen noodles, you can... just add them in at the last minute.
Number six, do the same with the eggs, if you're using eggs. Then peel them, which is the fun bit.
Here we go. Let's find out just how soft boiled they are. There are some people that can do this. Oh, amazing. The whole thing just came off.
Number seven. Put a portion of the noodles into a big bowl for each person. Lay the veg over them, then ladle over the hot broth. Sprinkle the tofu with sesame seeds and add it to the bowls. garnish generously and serve with a frothy cold lager.
Back in Sydney, one of the first things I make is the hand-pulled noodles for a family dinner. And after that, I pick up the recipe cards again and I start planning the next meal.
That story was produced by Lydia Yosifova. The supervising producer was Ryan Pemberton. The voice you heard at the end was Lydia's friend Max, reading the recipe card he made for her.
Cute.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. Nehemiah Kamanda grew up in Liberia. After a brutal civil war broke out, he and his family spent over a decade living in refugee camps across Africa. A content warning, this story contains graphic descriptions of violence. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14 or online at lifeline.org.au.
When I was growing up in Liberia, it was a very good country for anybody to grow in. Really, I was born in the 60s, 1967 to be specific. I had a very good education background. I went to good elementary school. I went to good junior high school. Everything was fine. We have good natural resources. We have good vegetation. We have everything that other countries had. Liberia has been just Liberia.
Starting 50 years before the end of slavery in America, a group called the American Colonization Society established a colony in what is now Liberia. The society sent nearly 12,000 free-born and formerly enslaved black people to the colony.
So in the 1800s up to 1980, it was being ruled by free slaves from America.
Tensions were always high between the native-born Africans and the Americo-Liberians. In the 1980s, that tension erupted into violence.
That was the time the country started to experience hardship and everything started going helter-skelter.
In 1980, the indigenous military leader Samuel Doe staged a violent coup and assassinated the Serbian American-descended president. In 1989, an invading force of rebels sought to oust the corrupt regime of then-president Samuel Doe.
After 10 years, 1990, when we had a civil war, things became so deplorable, people began to catch hard time. You know, suffering, only the few people could get rich. The poor people continued to be more poorer. Because of that, the people decided to take law into their own hand. That's what led to the Civil War. You know, houses got burned. The rebels could shoot anybody that... People were so, you know, envious of one another at the time. Like, I'm living in this house and the next person is living in another house. I will remember what you did to me in the past, and I will just take gun and go to you because I hate you and just kill you.
During the Civil War, thousands of civilians were murdered by warring rebel groups.
People were just pointing fingers on people. This person is that, this person is that. And they just, my mother had already been burned in a hot fire. It was so ugly. People died. Pregnant women, baby pulled out from their stomach, hair chopped, hands chopped. Liberia was a country where people ate human beings during the war. That how people used to survive, to eat you up.
What led to that? What was happening?
As I said from the beginning, people hate people and they get killed you for nothing. You're going to see that and just stay to where you are. You have to escape.
Nehemiah and his family fled to the neighboring Ivory Coast. But there, Nehemiah and his family found no peace.
Africa was the worst place we ever lived. Because in the refugee camp, the United Nations were helping us with food and shelter. So it was difficult to live. You wake up in the morning, you don't have any food to eat, you have to go to the UN office. We were there from 1996 to the year 2000 when another civil war erupted into that country. We had to run away to another country for safety.
Which one was that?
Guinea.
In Guinea, Nehemiah's whole family lived in one room of a divided tent for 12 years. He had lost his country. He and his family had seen unspeakable horrors. There seemed to be nothing to look forward to. Just more war, more destruction, and more nightmares.
Did you feel cursed at this point? Were you just like, oh, war is following me?
Yeah, of course. War was following me and we could not go back to our own country because from one country to another, you're running away from the war. It was so difficult.
Through all this, Nehemiah never lost hope.
We believe in God. We know that at the end of our suffering, there is hope. We always had hope that one of these days, there will be hope. There will be light in the tunnel. We're going to have hope. We're going to be saved. We're going to be free. We're going to have better life ahead of us. So no matter what we are going through in the refugee camp, God is in control. We're going to have hope. So our hope was really resting in God.
Nehemiah and his family had his prayers answered. The United Nations selected his family to be resettled in Australia, a place that sits so far away from the West African coast.
If you look at the map from Liberia to Australia, Australia is a country, a continent, and an island. So when the United Nations first of all told us you're going to Australia, some people refused to come because they said the country was so far. Or, you know, Liberia is close to America, so everybody from Liberia wants to go to America. Oh, America, America.
Despite any misgivings, Nehemiah decided to take his family across the world to Australia.
But this time around, when we got this opportunity to come, even though I was afraid, but I said to myself, I am 100% sure human beings live in Australia. They are not goats, they are not animals, they are not pigs, they are human beings. I think it's better for me to go to Australia to die there than to die in a refugee camp where my body will be thrown away in the bush. So United Nations will not tell me to go to a country that is bad. I will take the opportunity.
Today, Nehemiah is living on the outskirts of Newcastle. He works as a carer, helping people with disabilities. But Nehemiah's thoughts often go back to those hard times in Africa and the family members, like his mother and father, who didn't make it.
Sometimes when I sit down for long and think about it, I feel sad. But later on, I guess it will. I'm the child of God. I'm happy what happened. Because the Bible says, in everything that happened to us, we should give God thanks. Maybe that's how God decided to do it. And I just come from there and just do my thing. Take my little one, drink my wine, rejoice myself, go to work, go to visit friends. That's it. But I still have that memory for what happened in the war.
That story was produced by Lawrence Hamilton. The supervising producer was Ryan Pemberton. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14 or online at lifeline.org.au. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay and Angela Moran are our social media producers, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find more episodes by searching for All the Best wherever you get your podcasts.